With me for a return visit to Fresh Air is Gloria Steinem, who was a guest last summer during the 10th anniversary celebration of the founding of Ms. Magazine. As Ms. went on to be the most successful, most mainstream, and probably most influential feminist publication, Gloria Steinem became a kind of cultural icon, from morning newspapers to late-night TV talk shows. She was portrayed as everything from a shrill, quote, women's libber, to a savvy social critic, to a new breed of sex symbol. Her hair and aviator glasses were reproduced and sometimes parodied in magazines ranging from Time to Mad, but Gloria Steinem's career as a writer began long before she co-founded Ms. Magazine. 9 years earlier, in 1963, she infiltrated the Playboy Bunnies for a magazine for Show Magazine, for an article for Show Magazine, and that article prompted a million-dollar libel suit from the New York Playboy Club, and it also brought writing assignments on subjects from Dorothy Parker and Truman Capote to the auction of Zsa Zsa Gabor's bed. She quickly became involved in liberal and later feminist political causes and worked as a writer for the campaign of people like Robert Kennedy, Shirley Chisholm, George McGovern, Bella Abzug, and Cesar Chavez. She co-founded New York Magazine and wrote a column for it until 1971. She co-founded Ms. in 1972, where she is still an editor and writer. Gloria Steinem helped found the National Women's Political Caucus, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, the Women's Action Alliance, and the Ms. Foundation for Women. And in 1977, she was a member of the International Women's Year Commission that organized the Houston Women's Conference. She's received many awards for her activism and writing. Her new book is a collection of essays titled Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. It includes a new piece called Ruth's Song Because She Could Not Sing It, about her mother. Gloria Steinem will be at a book signing this afternoon from 5:30 to 6:30 at B. Dalton's at 1431 Chestnut Street. Her new book, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, is published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Gloria Steinem, good to see you, and welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that understanding introduction. So different from most introductions. Thank you.
You began your writing career trying not to be pigeonholed into women's writing, and women's writing had a very different meaning than it does now. What would you have been writing about if you were writing women's issues then?
Makeup, food, child-rearing, and child-rearing from a very traditional point of view. Obviously, that can be a very interesting subject. Fashion, interviews with the wives of famous men. So because of the subject matter, and also because feminism hadn't yet dawned on me, and I thought that the best way to gain approval was to separate myself from women's subject matter, in effect, I struggled very hard not to take those kinds of assignments and to get political assignments, by which I then meant mainly the electoral system or mainly Vietnam. I mean, I still didn't see women as political. I saw the civil rights movement, other things, but not women. And the farthest away I could get from that were profiles, by and large. That is, I couldn't get political assignments because I was a woman, and it was very rarely possible to get them. So mostly I was doing profiles of actors and writers and some social commentary after New York Magazine was founded. That was a good place for writers. But even so, I wrote a great many things in those days which simply were to make a living.
Before I had a chance to read your book, several people who had been reading about it or who had just grabbed a copy of it said, "Did you know that Gloria Steinem used to be a Playboy bunny?" And I have a feeling that a lot of people have really misinterpreted that and thought that this wasn't something that you did as a journalist to find out what life was like on the inside there, but rather, you know, you really wanted to be a Playboy bunny and had really believed in that concept. Do you find that has happened to you a lot?
Oh, yes. For 20 years, people have been introducing me as an ex-Playboy bunny and using that in a variety of ways, most of them unpleasant. I was real sorry I did it after I did it because it turned out to be a career error. I had just begun to get serious assignments. I had one on the United States Information Agency, which I wanted very much to write about because I'd lived in India and discovered how distorted the information given out by the USIA was. But that was taken away as soon as the bunny piece was very successful, and instead I was supposed to be a hooker on 42nd Street or be a call girl or whatever and write about that. I must say now, though, I feel a bit ashamed of my of my shame then, if you see what I mean. Because what's wrong with having been a Playboy bunny? Why should we want to separate ourselves from the women who are there, in fact, because they have children to support or because they have no office skills? I mean, when I went to work there, I had made up a background that I thought was suitable by saying that I had been a secretary, but it was boring and I wanted to make more money. And the young woman who interviewed me, the so-called bunny mother, who was herself about 24 years old, said, "Honey, if you can type, what do you want to work here for?" And then, of course, there were also women who were there because they believed, hoped, that perhaps a movie producer would come in and discover them in much the same way that poor people hope that maybe they'll win the lottery. But it was many years before I understood that there's, you know, that the reason why I felt such sympathy and empathy with the women who were there, because in a larger sense, we're all bunnies. I mean, we're all identified by our outsides instead of our heads and our hearts. So I finally reconciled myself to it and realized it was probably a good thing to have done to expose those working conditions. It did change the working conditions somewhat.
One of the things that piece really brings out is that being a bunny is hard physical labor, where you're lugging around heavy trays all the time and doing it on spiky high heels that are difficult to walk on that nearly ruined your feet.
Mm-hmm. It's anybody who's ever been a waitress, I think, has a great respect for how difficult it is, because you're both dealing with the public and doing hard physical labor. And to have to do that job in 3-inch high heels and a costume that's so tight in the waist that it makes your thighs cold because it cuts off the circulation and all of the padding of gym socks and dry cleaning bags and so on that's stuffed in your bosom so you look properly distorted in the bunny mode. It's very, very tough work. And the amount of money that had been promised to us as bunnies was 2 times at least anything we ever got.
Playboy, run by men, for men, with women working in it. But the woman, the person you reported to, was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
What did she tell you about the way you should be relating to the male customers there? Was there any kind of a apologetic note in it? Or
no. No, I would say it ranged from totally unchallenging and simply, well, this is what you have to do. You know, you have to you say ritual sentences, "Hello, I am your bunny Marie. May I see your playbook?" You know, I mean, you had no individuality, and they taught you how to walk, how to serve, what to say, and so on. And that was simply matter of fact. To the bunnies themselves, who many of whom were quite bitter and funny, because, you know, they were turned into objects by this system, and their retaliation was in the bunny dressing room to talk about these men as they really saw them and experienced them. If anybody wants a little dose of reality and humor and a wonderful kind of underdog viciousness, you know, they have only to listen to what goes on in that dressing room.
As you pointed out, a lot of women take jobs like that because it pays better than the other options.
Well, it doesn't actually, it does not pay better than the other options. It's just that they don't have other options because they don't have even office skills, because it actually pays very badly. And you have to kick back your tips and pay for your costume and, you know, all kinds of stuff that shouldn't be. Or else you have this hope, this slender hope that perhaps someone will, quote, discover you there, unquote.
I think maybe the more recent version of that is the professional cheerleaders now.
Oh, yes, you're right.
For sports teams.
That's quite true.
How do you put
that in perspective? The Dallas cheerleaders,
mm-hmm,
and so on.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that as a profession or as a phenomenon?
Well, I imagine that it is very similar, as you say. It is one of the few ways that women can gain recognition, and thus it has an appeal, you know, because you do get a certain amount of material reward and support and flattery for the way you look physically. On the other hand, in order to get that, you have to be cheerleading for men and giggling and laughing and saying how clever of you to know what time it is and all the kinds of stuff that we, to be in effect a female impersonator. I mean, you know, I always used to wonder why I was made so uncomfortable if I went to a nightclub or a theater where there were female impersonators, and I realized it's because they do what I do, or what I try not to do now, but anyway, what I was trained to do.
Playboy has reproduced the photograph. Did you ever consider suing them in the context that they used it in?
Well, I once talked to a lawyer about it, but it would have been a very difficult suit. I mean, I should explain to the listeners that they take employee photographs, which, you know, are just you in your bunny costume. I mean, they aren't indecent in any sense, but there you are, you know, as a bunny. So they had a photograph of me, and they continue to use it or other news photographs in their publications saying that I was an ex-bunny, and they've done so for 20 years. The most annoying one is, one of the most annoying is a current one-shot publication on bunnies, which says that I was a bunny and that my article on being a bunny actually increased their applicants, which I do not believe for a moment. Not for a moment. but this is their revenge, you know, that they've kept on doing it for 20 years, I suppose, means that they were stung by the article.
My guest is Gloria Steinem. What were the political issues that concerned you before feminism?
Well, I had lived in India for 2 years when I first got out of college, and that affected me very deeply. In the 50s, there was a very different atmosphere in this country, and so much so that we had not even really focused on the racism of the country or people who were really poor and hungry here at home. It's the book Hunger in America that Mike Harrington wrote. Or was it Poverty in America? Well, in any case, his very landmark expose of poverty in this country had not even been published yet. So I was, even though I had come from a very poor neighborhood, in some ways because I had come from a poor neighborhood, I had a certain amount of naivete, a big amount of naivete about what this country was like politically. And moreover, I thought that this country was what the world was like. So when I got to India and discovered a very different reality and figured out that, in fact, we are the odd people in this world with so much to eat and so much, you know, such prosperity. I came back to this country with an incredible sense of urgency. It was really naive, but, I mean, I had discovered poverty, right? So I came back wanting to talk about India. This was 1958. Was much too early for anybody to be interested in India. They just, when I tried to tell them about it, they kind of dropped off. but it gave me a great sense of connection to third world countries. So I was, ironically, much more interested in the poverty of third world countries than I was in the poverty within my own country. At the same time, I felt an emotional connection with discriminated against groups here, and the civil rights movement was just beginning then in the early 60s. So it was that kind of concern that I had. I didn't stop to figure out why I felt so emotionally connected. I, by then, a middle-class person, you know, to the farm workers or to the civil rights movement. And I think that happens to a lot of women. We just identify with the underdog in a big way, but we don't know why. But those were the kinds of issues I was concerned with. But I still thought that you pursued those issues by lobbying and pressuring and writing speeches for the most decent of the politicians and getting that person elected. I still hadn't figured out that you had to get different people elected and get a kind of populist uprising going if you were going to change the pressures on anybody in political office.
How is your political work circumscribed by your gender?
Well, first of all, I was always volunteering. I never once got paid. And in retrospect, I realized that the men who were doing this similar work were getting paid, but I didn't even question that at the time. Secondly, I was always having to hide out because the presence of a young woman in the political campaign made everybody worry that somebody would think the candidate was having an affair with you, one, or two, that if you were writing speeches, the speeches couldn't be very important. So there was the irony of being locked up in a room someplace, working and then pretending you weren't there or that you hadn't done the work. Also, there was you were made to feel or maybe this was already in my head, I don't know, that your suggestions wouldn't be taken seriously from you. So if I was sitting next to a man in a political meeting, I frequently would give him my suggestion because I knew that then it was more likely to get done. Even after I became more active, for instance, I remember raising most of the money for George McGovern's little miniature presidential campaign in 1968. If you'll remember, there was Humphrey as the what was seen as the pro-Vietnam candidate, since he was the legacy of Lyndon Johnson, and Eugene McCarthy was the peace candidate. Except that Eugene McCarthy happened to have a very limited appeal and wasn't really against it. I mean, there were a lot of problems with his candidacy. So in order to break the first ballot, McGovern launched a candidacy. And it was a little miniature presidential campaign, and I did a lot of the fundraising and the advance work and so on. And yet his own Senate staff didn't want me in the office at all. They were quite alarmed when they saw me because they had thought I was an old woman. And so when they saw me, they kept saying, get her out of here, you know. Because somebody will think George is having an affair with her. It was just awful. It was terrible.
Did you protest that at the time?
Well, it hurt my feelings a lot. I think I did protest some of it. But mostly I had this sneaking suspicion it was my fault. Well, maybe if I dressed differently. You know, maybe if I did something differently. It's awful how long you can go on, you know, thinking that somehow this is your unique experience. And I think what finally changed my mind and helped me understand were two things. One, the Chicago Convention in 1968, which was a deep political education for a lot of us who were there, because we finally realized that, well, that there was such a thing as a police riot, for instance, the structure, the political structure, was really very deeply corrupt in many ways, and also that... from a woman's point of view, or any outsider's point of view, that you had to have an autonomous, independent movement and elect your own people. Because even after I had done all this with McGovern, and his 1972 candidacy was to be discussed, this was just a couple of months after Chicago, he invited me to a meeting to discuss it, and one of his supporters, you know, said, no broads. This is Ribicoff, from Connecticut. And George said, wait a minute, you know, she raised all this money, she wrote speeches, and Ribicoff said, sorry, no broads. And George, who was a very decent human being, accepted it in a way that he never would have had Ribicoff said, no blacks or no Jews or whatever. And indeed, Ribicoff is Jewish, you know. But that was an awakening to me. And at the same time, other things were happening. Women were holding abortion speak-outs, and I was going to feminist meetings, and it just all became clear, you know, that there was just, you couldn't ask for freedom, you had to take it.
I think you arrived at the point of view that the personal is political, and that politics
absolutely
was a lot more than what happened in Washington, yes. D.C. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that as a 50s person, I had been taught that what happens to women is due to biology or Freud or God or something, you know, but that it's sort of immutable. And maybe you as an individual can escape this system by some miracle, but that actually the system is going to remain in place. So I just didn't question it. And I thought that politics was what went on in Washington or, you know, some state capital or something. And it was feminists who had also come out of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. I mean they had definitely maintained those concerns, but they had realized that within those movements they were being treated the same as women in the Republican Party were. I mean, they were also doing the mimeographing and expected to, you know, do sexual services and so on. So they had begun to have speak-outs on all of the issues that, like abortion, that ironically weren't even taken up by, say, the socialists or the Marxists in New York, you know, those group, because they said, well, you know, you can't build a mass movement on these issues or something. I don't know. So in a funny way, even the socialists were the right wing of the women's movement, weren't feminists at that point. It's changed a lot now. And I started to realize that, you know, to go to those speak outs and go to those Well, it was just like a light bulb going off in my head. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, it's like, it is in a sense like being reborn, because you come to realize that your own experience is valid and that politics indeed is every power relationship in our lives. Anytime one group or one individual is dominant over another group or individual, a lot of the time, and it has nothing to do with talent or experience, but just to do with how you got born, whether it's race or sex or class, that's politics. So it is serious who does the dishes and who doesn't. And it is serious who types and who doesn't. It's fundamental. And moreover, I think this is this kind of organic understanding is what the great social justice movements have to bring to political thought, to understand that revolutions like houses can't really be built from the top down. I mean, they really have to be built from the bottom up.
Once you started speaking out on feminist issues, and certainly once myths began to be published, you were really adopted by the media as the one person who most symbolized the feminist movement. And because of that, your image appeared in many places and was caricatured in many places. There were very few women in the press at that point to interpret what feminism was, and it was left mostly to men, many of whom really didn't understand what was happening at all. What did you think of that early press coverage, not only of the movement, but also of you as an mm-hmm. individual who were used to being in the press and not being written about by the press?
Well, it was a real education as a journalist, and I think it would be quite healthy for all journalists to have to be written about.
Mm-hmm.
I wish all journalism schools would cause their students to pick out of a hat the name of one professional journalist and then pay that journalist to do a profile of the student, and the student would have to know that that profile was going to follow them around and be in their obit file. Because you realize how easy it is to distort something, and indeed, when you're interviewed, you realize how hard it is to tell the truth short, and how much mythology there is in the press. I soon learned that for any social activist or organizer, the best thing to do is to be on television or on radio, because you may mess up, but you have a fighting chance of getting across what you really mean. In the written press, the reporter has the opportunity to pick what they want and to describe what you have on and so on. I think we'd have better journalists if everybody had the experience of being written about. But women, whatever our race or group, are subject to a very special kind of ridicule and a special habit of identifying us by how we look, by our relationships to men, by our sexuality. All of that happened to me and to everybody else. I hope that at no time was I the only person people thought about as a feminist, because it's terribly important that there always be diversity. And we would frequently only be interviewed together or in a group, you know, to try to make that happen. But it took the heart out of you. You know, I mean, if I was standing next to Henry Kissinger at some political event. Actually, in this case, I was also standing next to George McGovern, but since McGovern was married, they cut him out of the picture, published the picture of me and Kissinger, and sent it all over the world. People still ask me if I was a girlfriend of Henry Kissinger, which, both at the level of truth and politics, makes me crazy. You know? And I don't think a male journalist standing next to some woman, you know, would have been assumed to be the possession of that woman. Well, it's endless, you know. You could go through, you know, all kinds of examples, but it's very humiliating.
You describe in the book a couple of bizarre things. We'd turn on the TV and saw an ad for an exploitation movie mm-hmm. with a woman who was obviously supposed to evoke you.
Oh, yes, that was for a book, which I've never had the courage to read. I think it was called The Symbol, and it was an ad. You know how in the early morning shows they have ads for books, and so it showed this woman who had my glasses and hair, but she was in a very slinky slip, you know, and she was kind of, you know, slouching forward towards a table on which there was a necklace with a feminist symbol on it. And the voiceover, a man, of course, was saying, you know, she uses men but prefers women. The symbol. It sort of sets you back. You know, you're just getting up in the morning, you see that.
Did Did you call anyone up? I mean, like the people who did the commercial or the publisher up about it?
No, because it was clear to me there was nothing I could do about it. You know, I mean, I used to say that I wished I could buy the legal rights to my own life. But once you're a public figure, there's nothing that can be done about it. They changed the name in the book, but of course it was clear that who it was supposed to be. There was also another novel about New York Magazine in which I was a character, I'm told. I also didn't read that one, in which I also was a lesbian or used men in some way. I don't know. It's just so depressing. I do think that that's changed a lot. I don't think that women who become active now and enter the public eye have to put up with, well, there's still some of that, but I hope it's not nearly as much.
I think one of the really horrifying things that you document in your book is what Richard Speck said, which is that not all the women he murdered were like Gloria mm-hmm. Steinem. What was the context of that?
I tried to get the tape again, and I couldn't, but he was being interviewed in prison. He was in a prison cell. Several people called me up about it because they were so alarmed by it. And it is true that, you know, men who have got hooked on male dominance, you know, then see a woman who is even just in the least a person, you know, as a threat. And apparently, you know, that was him. And of course, we see that in all kinds of sexual assault cases and murder cases.
How have you managed to keep your personal life out of the press? And I think you really have succeeded in doing that.
You think so? I feel like it's an open book somehow.
I think that for someone who has gotten as much press coverage as you have, that really the overwhelming majority of the press coverage, from what I've seen, has been about your views and maybe about like your lifestyle and all, but very little really about, you know, like who you're with and you know, the real private parts of private life. It seems to me that maybe I'm wrong, but from my point of view, it seems like you've succeeded as much as you can
right
in your position.
In the last 10 years or so, that's probably right. In the late 60s, having got really burned by all these examples that I'm discussing, and also since the accusation of being a lesbian was so frequent, and since it was such a clear desertion of my friends and sisters who were lesbians to say, no, I'm not, I just said, well, it's irrelevant what my private life is, you know, and I just tried to only do press conferences about issues and not to give personal interviews. And I did do that for many years in a reaction, I suppose, to the kinds of coverage that had been there in the beginning. And the odd thing is that in recent years, people have said to me, I mean, people whose judgment I trust, have said, well, you know, you don't seem, people are now surprised when you're, you know, funny or when you know, I don't know that I having struggled so hard to be taken seriously at all, then people were beginning to tell me I was taken too seriously, which I found very bizarre.
Can't win.
And so on the occasion of this book, I've done some more personal interviews. I don't know whether it was a good or bad thing to do. I'm not sure.
I guess you'll find out after they're published.
Right. Well, no, I did one on 2020, which I haven't seen myself, but one with Barbara Walters. And some, you know, some in the press too. But I think we owe it to other women. I mean, the personal is political. So, and by now, hopefully we can be honest about our private lives and be seen as whole people. We don't want to come across as fragments to other women.
There's one slightly personal question I'd like to ask you. This isn't terribly
That's
personal.
That's fine.
By
if
any
you
means.
Ask me, it's completely different.
when you were first becoming a feminist activist, it was before there was a big feminist movement nationally and before it was really acceptable to be a single woman or to even not have children. Mm-hmm. Did that decision plague you, knowing that, you know, at a certain point you had to decide if you were going to have a nuclear family of your mm-hmm. own or not?
No, well, here's what happened. It was sort of gradual, to put it mildly. It sort of happened in increments because I was a 50s person who had been taught the 50s version of marriage, which is that, you know, if you marry, you have to take his name, his identity, you know, all of those things. That's what I thought would happen. So I kept putting it off. It isn't as if I said to myself, I'm not going to get married. It's just that I said, oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to get married, because I thought everyone did. But right now, because I have this other thing I want to do now. So it just kept being put off into the future. And meanwhile, I was quite happy, actually, not being married. And thanks to feminism, I began to realize that it was okay not to be married. Not everybody had to be married.
The women's movement, and I think you, because you are attractive, were criticized for being privileged. People saw the women's movement as being middle-class women who are educated, who wouldn't have to work if they didn't want to, because, mm-hmm. you know, they could have husbands who could support them. What were your responses to personal and movement criticisms of being privileged?
Well, my earliest responses, I think, and those of, well, first of all, I always spoke together with another woman, mainly because I had stage fright about speaking by myself, but it turned out to be a good thing because the other woman I spoke with was a black feminist, and it turned out to be good that we arrived at the same time, and therefore had much more mixed audiences and so on. So when we got this we didn't get this accusation as much because in and of ourselves, we were presenting the idea that feminism was for everybody. And in addition, especially Margaret Sloan, who was my speaking partner, was very helpful because she used to just say things I hadn't thought about. You know, she would say, well, look, Dr. King was a middle-class person. Stokely Carmichael went to Howard University. By and large, the people who are able to go to meetings in the first instance are people with a little bit of breathing space in their lives. And you can't expect the poorest of the poor to go to a meeting unless they know that this meeting is really going to be helpful. And also that the women's movement, with all of its problems and divisions that we mourn over and try to fix, is still more economically and racially integrated than any other movement. Now, since in recent time, I've discovered something interesting just as a result of this book, and that is that, again, I was being perceived as more privileged than I actually was, because there's a chapter there about my mother, which in the process of talking about my mother talks about my own childhood. And I find that people are amazed that I didn't grow up in this enormously rich and privileged way. I'm not trying to separate myself from privileged women, because the truth is that class works in reverse for women in a lot of ways, and upper-class women are more likely to be restricted and kept as ornaments and children and so on, and it's a whole set of problems. But that I, you know, grew up semi-poor and, you know, lived in a lousy neighborhood and had a bad time and so on is apparently a surprise to people who read this chapter. So this has caused me to think about style, and I realize that probably there is a very narrow range of acceptable style in which women are allowed to come to the public. We're supposed to act, quote, like ladies, unquote. And I certainly tried very hard to do that. So as a kid, you know, because I was trying to, I mean, that's what we were taught to do in my neighborhood. It was very important. So I suppose that I, you know, gave people this impression. And in a sense, we end up betraying our own backgrounds by pretending to be something else. We have to have a wide range of styles that are okay. And there aren't very many women who have a different, an other than, quote, ladylike style. There's Bella Abzug. I'm very proud of her because she has, you know, a wonderful kind of street style. But we have to think about this. I mean, it's caused me to think about the whole area of how we present ourselves. Not just clothes, which is sort of secondary, but our physical styles.
Well, clothes is very political in a way, too, because you're expected to wear certain things for certain positions, but it might be clothes that are slightly disabling. You know?
No, that's true. That's absolutely true. We had a series of focus meetings around the country for Ms. Magazine because we wanted to hear in a very free way, you know, what kinds of things people wanted in the magazine, what they liked and didn't like. And one of the things that was unexpected but interesting was that women are so angry about Dress for Success. I mean, there is, you know, smoke coming out of their ears with the idea that they have to imitate men in order to be. I mean, you know, it's fine. Women want to wear a suit, fine. But the idea that you have to, you know, dress in a certain way is most annoying. So we're going to do a cover story about how women really dress as opposed to how Mr. Malloy in his book tells us we should dress.
Gloria Steinem is my guest, and if you'd like to read some of her essays, she has a new collection that dates back from 1963 and runs up to about the present. Well, to the present, there's even a previously unpublished essay in there. It's called Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. The previously unpublished essay, in addition to the introductory essay, is about your mother, the one you were just referring to. And you discuss how your mother was disabled for many years by an emotional illness that also had her institutionalized during periods. You, I think, did some research into this afterwards. Do you feel that there were social reasons as well as emotional reasons for her problem?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so interesting to me that I could ignore it for so long, you know, because my mother was an invalid by the time I was growing up. I just kept saying to myself, well, I'm not going to be anything like my mother. A familiar refrain of daughters, I think. And it was only many, many, many years later, after I had in the first place come to meet her for the first time, that is, after she got out of the mental hospital where she was part of the time I was in college, or even while she was there, I began to meet the person she had been before I was born and to see there was this whole other person inside. And then through looking at the politics of my life and other women's lives, I began to realize that this was not at all unusual, that this breaking of women's spirit was so common that we didn't even think that it was anything wrong with it, unless we stopped to think what would happen to a man who had a profession that he loved and it was taken away from him, who had friends that he cared about and a life that he could, and a name, and all this was taken away. We wouldn't be surprised if that guy got depressed, you know, but we accept that that's what's going to happen to women. But it took me a long time to realize it. And I think that there are many women like my mother. We're all women like my mother in some degree.
What was her reaction to feminism?
Well, I think her reaction to me and my life was basically positive. That is, she was proud that I was a writer because my mother had been a writer and had been forced to give it up. So she, you know, I found after her death all of my clippings that she had saved, and she was very proud. And I think in a funny way, she was proud that I didn't marry, although she was also very worried by it and afraid. And she would say to me when I came home things like, you know, your sister, this is my older sister who is married and has six children, your sister just got a new winter coat and she didn't have to pay for it herself, you know, because my mother was worried about me. But I think she was proud of all that. Feminism per se made her nervous because she feared conflict. So she would, when she went to meetings with her friends and they had name tags on, sometimes she would use a different name because she didn't want
them to know she was your
right.
mother?
Right, yeah, because not because she wasn't proud of me, but because she was afraid that someone would argue with her. And if somebody did start to argue, you know, and say, well, I don't agree, and this, and my mother would say, oh, you're a feminist, don't worry about it. You know, she just would avoid it. And once I had a picket, I remember, who was picketing me personally outside a meeting in Washington, and he was selling pamphlets saying that I was, you know, against God and a representation of the devil and all of that. And my mother went out and bought a pamphlet from him because she was trying to be nice. You know, she was so fearful of conflict, and I think, and I see that in myself too. I'm afraid of conflict too.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, it makes my stomach churn. But she just had it in a greater degree.
Well, one conflict you had to deal with your mother, you were going to sign, you did sign a petition in support of abortion, and it was signed by women who had public stature, who were publicly known, and who came out and said, I have had an abortion, mm-hmm. and I support reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was very afraid of this and kind of embarrassed by this public admission. How did you decide what you wanted to do to, like, prevent your mother from feeling hurt and upset, or, you know, to compromise your own ability to be effective on the issue?
Well, to be honest, there was never any question in my mind but what I had to say it, because I was asking other women to say it. You see, this was a petition that was being printed in the first issue, the first regular issue of Ms. Magazine, and it was patterned after a petition signed by hundreds of French women who had done the same thing. So, saying that is never easy, and I could see that everybody I was asking to do this had problems doing it. Billie Jean King, for instance, got a lot of unfortunate publicity because she admitted she'd had an abortion, and people would say, well, she just wanted to make money in this match, and so she sacrificed a baby it was extremely unpleasant. So that made me realize that if she could deal with that, and if all these other women could, then I could too. And though my mother really was hurt by it and understandably hurt me in return, I think that in a deeper way it made it possible for us to be more honest later, and we had many more discussions about sexual subjects later, which we'd never had before.
Do you think seeing her sacrifice her career to bring up her children and raise a family affected your view of family?
Probably, yeah. As I say, I didn't think about it until an alarmingly late age. I think that I assumed that if I had children, that I would be almost uniquely responsible for them, and that if I married, I would probably end up sacrificing more than he would.
You've written that you think women are the one group that grow more radical with age. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, we look at the male pattern of activism, which in general, I don't mean there aren't big exceptions, but in general is to be rebellious when young and grow somewhat more conservative with age. And we assume that that's the only one. So I noticed that journalists are always going to campus to look for what they imagine to be the red hot center of feminist activity. Now there's plenty, there's enormous, courageous feminist activity on campus and women's studies and rape crisis hotlines but it isn't, most issues didn't start there, and, it isn't the peak of the activity. And if you stop to figure out why, I think there are very good reasons for that. I think that the average 18 or 20-year-old woman has, to the extent that women have power, in an anthropological sense, has more power than she will later on. At 18 or 20, she's a sex object. She's an actual or a potential child bearer. She's a young and energetic worker. And she loses power and probably has less power when she's 40 or 50, traditionally, than she did at 18 or 20. Now, men go the other way around. The average 40 or 50-year-old guy probably has more power than he did at 18 or 20. Another way of saying it is that women, when we're young, haven't experienced what's wrong yet. I mean, we haven't been in the labor force, we haven't been married, had kids, or aged, and all of those things are bigger penalties for women.
Do you think you've gotten more radical as you've gotten older?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
In what ways?
Well, I think that when I first started being active as a feminist, I was very naive, and even though I realized there had to be an autonomous women's movement, I was still asking men, to give us something. And I thought that if we just explained and demonstrated these injustices, which were so enormous, that surely people would want to change them. I was just very naive about the kinds of power that depend on those injustices. As a result, I got burned out. And I think in a real sense, burnout is a function of naivete. Because you think, well, if you just work at this absolutely all the time and every minute, that it'll be over. And you don't pace yourself. Once you realize this is a lifetime, you pace yourself better, and you realize how important it is to have times of rest and refueling for yourself, and also to replace yourself, not to keep doing what you already know how to do, but to help another woman learn how to do that. You get a sense of perspective.
Gloria Steinem is my guest if you're just tuning in. One of the things we discussed at the beginning of the interview was your work in liberal political campaigns in the 1960s, which you left to help work for feminism and to create a grassroots feminist movement. Mm-hmm. That's kind of been established already, and a lot of feminists are looking back at the political arena mm-hmm. again. What do you see happening politically now? How much influence do you think women have and feminists have in, say, for instance, the upcoming presidential campaign?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to say that what influence we have depends on our having on our own organizations, on mobilizing our own vote and having our own freestanding autonomous groups, because we won't have power inside the structure unless we have a threat outside. So I don't see it as separate. I see it as a continuum. And though the electoral system is not where change is initiated, it is where it can be won or lost. It's where it gets consolidated. So I do think that the growth of the gender gap is due to the growth of the women's movement. Now, there has always been a gender gap on issues, but it's just much bigger than it used to be. And, of course, Reagan has made it partisan for the first time. I suppose that's the one thing we could thank him for, since the press doesn't care what women want unless it can influence which man gets elected. But the question is really, in the electoral sense, whether or not we will turn out in 1984. I'm very worried about it, because now that the press has discovered the gender gap, and it's clear that if women, even 60% of women, turned out, there would be no more Ronald Reagan. If we don't turn out, I'm afraid we will be treated to a contempt like never before, because they will say, well, yeah, they care, they have these issues, but they don't care about them enough to vote. Now, it's true also that it's harder for women to vote, both because we don't have a reason to believe historically that it's going to affect our lives that much, though I think Reagan has done a lot to make us understand the danger of a negative guy in office, and because we have kids, it's harder to get to the polls. But we really have to help each other get to the polls, and all the women's organizations, all the battered women's shelters and the rock bands and the rape crisis hotlines and so on, we all have to make sure that the people we are in touch with, our members, the people we serve, that we ask them in what election districts they live and provide childcare and get people out, that we have voter registration drives in supermarkets and shopping centers. Because I really think that the public attention is focused on this. And also, there's the real danger of another 4 years of Ronald Reagan, which is, you know, literally life and death, means literally life and death or health or disease, you know, to lots of women. It's really important that we use this populist power we've developed.
You said before that you thought probably, that you were sure that things weren't as bad for visible women now, women visible in their professions as they were when you started.
I don't mean to make, I guess it depends where they are. I don't mean to make that kind of judgment, because I know that individual women are, you know, having a very bad time.
What I was going to ask you is that a lot of people think, well, battle's won.
Oh, no. Do you think so?
Well, I think some people think that, yeah.
Well, it seems to me that's only very young women who are maybe their students. So since they're paying money, tuition, they're being treated with more equality than they ever will be again. College is delighted to get their money, you know, so that nobody emphasizes the fact that they're going to get paid half as much after they get out. But we can't really think that the battle is over without also thinking that women are inferior, because if we look at where women are, then we would have to say that that's where women deserve to be.
You have some criticisms of the press, which we've discussed, yet you're a member of the press at the same time. What conclusions do you reach, that the press isn't monolithic?
Well, I'm sort of a member of an alternate or semi-alternate publication, because uh-huh. it is owned and controlled by women, unlike any other magazine. So, you know, it's not underground. It's sort of semi-underground, I guess, but it's a different part of the press. But the press is not monolithic, no. I mean, you know, there are there are glacial forces at work there that you have to worry about, but there are individuals who are trying to do something very different, as you are. And I think also that we need both inside and outside the system. I mean, we need both autonomous, independent publications where we can be completely free in saying what we want to, and we need women who are infiltrating, you know, so to speak, the traditional and men with changed values, so that the changes are made there. Again, we need to surround the goal, not just approach it from one direction. But though I get terribly frustrated, especially on subjects like ERA coverage and, coverage of, I mean, right now, women are not ridiculed in the same way that they were 10 years ago. It's not seen as bra burners and so on. The new form of ridicule is to say women are a single issue. You know, the Panama Canal is the real thing, but half the human race is a single issue. A new form of, a sort of nice form of backlash is to talk about post-feminism. Or even the me generation, I'm suspicious of that too, because when the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, you know, make big fortunes, they're public-spirited creators of jobs, and all women have to do is say, I don't think I'll cook dinner tonight, and suddenly they're the me generation.
I want to thank you so very much for talking with us. It's really been great to talk with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, and thank you for this program.
My guest has been Gloria Steinem, who has a new collection of essays that covers the period of 1963 to the present. It's called Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, published by Holt Reinhardt Winston, and the title again, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. She's a founding editor of Ms. Magazine, which began publication 11 years ago, and she will be holding a book signing a little later in Philadelphia, if you'd like to meet her, and that will be at the B. Daltons at 5:30 to 6:30 at 1431 Chestnut Street. So that's at Daltons from 5:30 to 6:30 today at 1431 Chestnut Street. The name of her book again, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions.